Today on Off Mic, whether you supported him or not, President Trump had a large following, and much of that following does not trust the news media. That's a big problem for the press. How does the press win those people back? We talked to one local expert who says strengthening media literacy is the key. And we talked to a local writer about 100 things to do in Northwest Indiana before you die. All this on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. President Joe Biden is completing his first full week in office. The president has called for unity for the country and in Congress. As he continues his agenda, it remains to be seen how he attempts to reach out to supporters of President Trump. President Biden's problem is also a problem for the media. Why? Because many conservatives and or Trump supporters do not believe in the reporting of many in the media. The phrase fake news was not invented by President Trump, but he certainly popularized it. And President Trump used the phrase whether the story was accurate or not. If he didn't like it, he labeled it fake news. But even with President Trump no longer in office, you still hear Republicans or conservatives using that term. Some say it's an issue of media literacy. Joining me to talk about this issue is Susie Schultz, Executive Director of the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Susie, what an honor to welcome you here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Oh, it's my honor, Michael. It's really a pleasure. And it's great to be able to talk about this because this is such an important subject.
Susie, before we get into the subject, you've had a long history yourself in media. Can you tell our audience a little bit about your background?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I am one of the most unlikely museum heads you could find in that museums are really not my field, but my field does overlap well with this. For most of my career, I've been a journalist. I've been an editor. I would say I was an investigative editor for a chunk of that time as well. Run a couple of newsrooms, and I've been an academic. I've taught at Medill and at Columbia, and then I also had a little bit of time in the both the federal and the city government. I like to tell people I worked for a rabbi in federal government at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and then I worked for a nun in city government at the Chicago Department of Public Health just to balance life out. And then I came back into journalism to run another newsroom, and most recently before I took this job, I was working at the running a nonprofit, the Public Narrative. And Public Narrative is a wonderful nonprofit run by a woman named Jamira Alexander now. And what it does, its mission is better storytelling and elevating voices that people haven't heard. So we teach not only at Public Narrative, they teach not only people in nonprofits and in community how to tell their stories in a way that people can better hear it. But we also teach journalists as well how to tell their stories and how to actually move to elevate the importance of the industry. That's what I am. And I was, we were actually talking, I was at Public Narrative when the museum approached us to write a curriculum for them. I've written a number of curriculums. And so about news literacy and about the importance of all of this. And while we were talking about this, we have a founder who had been there for about 30 years. And then there was an executive director in Julian Jackson, who is also on our board right now. And he found his dream job. And so he was only there for about 18 months. And so he resigned during our discussions, and they asked me to apply for it. I said, really, I'm not a broadcaster. I've really been a print person most of my life. And they said, but you understand how to run a nonprofit. You understand how to do boards. You understand how to do, I said, well, yes. And you understand news literacy and especially media literacy as well, which are two different things, even though they overlap.
That's right. And, not to get too bogged down with this, but if for folks who are unfamiliar with the Museum of Broadcast Communication, it is certainly one of the places that if you haven't been there, and once the pandemic lifts and it's reopened, it is certainly, you should put it on your bucket list to get there, because it's certainly just a treasure in Chicago. People forget or don't realize the history Chicago played in the history of broadcasting here in Chicago, of course, and nationally. And there's just so many incredible artifacts, and it's just a real treat to go there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And we can't wait to be open again. But while we are not open, we have tried to pivot and put some of our work online. So we are really working on how to be a museum into of the future. So we and surprisingly enough, we have an older website, so we can't really host things there. So we're trying to figure that one out, Michael. But through this pandemic, we put up, it was really my first exhibit, you can find it at greatdebates.org. And greatdebates.org really talks about the influence that the broadcast industry, whether it's radio, television, or digital, has had and its impact on the elections. And greatdebates.org is actually rich, where there's a 100-year timeline with video and audio about the intersection of politics and presidential politics and the broadcast industries. And we look at it, because we are a nonprofit, we look at it in a really apolitical way, but we look at how you think about it, and you think about how fast in this century radio went to television, went to digital, and that all three of them are still robust. I mean, I know that robust might not be comparatively speaking, but they are still influential and they are still part of our lives. But each time the technology evolved, it really disrupted so much of society, right? And nowhere is that more clear than when you see and you skip 4 years with these presidential elections. So these presidential candidates couldn't necessarily, if they walked into the election thinking that they were going to run a campaign or that their people were going to run a campaign the way they did 4 years prior, they were totally wrong, you know, because you couldn't do what you did on radio and survive on television. We saw that with the very first debate with Kennedy and Nixon. And that disruption continued to affect presidential politics. And so that's what we explore on that. And we also want to make sure that the next generation understands some of this. So we have put up 9 modules of curriculum for high schoolers and middle schoolers. And also, I must say, for lifelong learners, some of this stuff is just fascinating, how it intersects.
You know, Susie, how do we get to a point? I mean, right now I feel like journalism is in a crisis, because no matter how much reporting you do, whatever due diligence you do, and you do a story, you report it, and you try to take as much bias out of there as possible, there is just a segment of society, a huge segment, and it seems to be growing, and it definitely did grow in the last 4 years under President Trump, that just do not believe mainstream media, big media, whatever you want to call it, even your local newspapers. We have a number of Republican office holders who just refuse to sit down and discuss policy or issues with even the local press. They'll go to, say, a friendly outlet like Fox News to do that. How dangerous is that for a free society?
Well, I think that, I think the founders understood that. The founders understood that that is really dangerous, period. The, even the man who wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, who actually hated the press, said that were I to have a society without news, choose whether I would have a society without news or without politicians, I would choose to have news. He knew the importance of it. He actually sued a number of outlets, Jefferson, but he was not but he knew how vital it was. And that is why when you read the First Amendment, It's in the First Amendment that a free press is part of this democracy. So a free press is actually the Fourth Estate. It's referred to the Fourth Estate because it's supposed to be the watchdog of the three branches of government. And I think where we have gotten a little off track on a number of things is that, and mind you, this sentiment about news is not unique to the United States. This is a global issue. So we're not alone on this. This is going on across the country. We might have set a tone that helped develop it, but it is a global issue that we all have to figure out. But I think one of the places that we've lost track of is that, you know, so here the media, the press, are the Fourth Estate, the watchdogs of the three branches of government, the executive, the judicial, and the congressional. But who are the watchdogs of the Fourth Estate? The Fifth Estate is the public. The Fifth Estate is the public, and this does not work without them. It does not work unless you are engaging with those media outlets, with those news outlets. And engaging with them is easier now than it ever was. You no longer have to write a letter. You can do a tweet. You can do a email. You can get a hold of people. The people who are in the media are out front now. They are identifiable. And we forget, if things bother us, to send a note. Michael, I didn't like that story that you did. I thought that wasn't correct. And we also have not taught the public what our standards and practices are. That is why we have been allowed to evolve off the tracks, where we have news stations that represent the right and that represent the left. And you know, actually, I know I'm monologuing here, Michael, but actually, is more the way things used to be. You know, it used to be, I worked for a little while at the small newspaper group, and the small newspaper group is run by the small family. And their grandfather was the governor of Illinois. And Governor Small, who actually was on trial for impeachment at one point, was hated by Colonel McCormick, who ran the Tribune. So much so that he literally cut him out of photographs. So if you go to find pictures of Governor Small in the archives of the Tribune, you're not going to find them. So, and the Small family knew that, you know, this was how the stories were dictated. So when he finished his role as governor, he actually bought a number of papers. So because papers were very, very partisan at that era. And it's only in this modern age where we came to the point where we have a code of ethics, where we have strict rules. People don't think we do. But if you look at the SPJ Code of Ethics, which is the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, there are strict rules for how we should operate. And we don't tell people that. We don't necessarily, one of the problems is we don't tell our own story, because we often write it off as quote unquote insider ball game.
So Susie, what is the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago doing to expand media literacy, either in the schools, or what is your mission to improve media literacy?
So I think the news literacy is really understanding how news works and how it's supposed to function and what it's supposed to do and how it's supposed to deliver information, right? And the covenant with a journalist should only be, I can only tell you what I know and where that came from. That way, if I'm telling you where it came from, if I'm telling you where the information came from, you can be the judge of how vital this is, whether it's important, whether there's bias involved, right? So I think when you add in media literacy expands that to include all of the media that we're consuming. Where does it come from? What is it doing? How does it influence us? At the Museum of Broadcast Communication, the era that we're in right now, one of the reasons why I was hired was I really do specialize in education. We want to teach people what's going on. We want to teach people what are the stories that we've seen on the media. And when we're talking about the media, again, we're talking about radio, we're talking about television, And we're talking about this whole amazing digital landscape that we're part of. But what are the stories that we're seeing? What are the stories that are being elevated? How does that shape society? And who is being left out? That is really kind of crucial. We consume a lot of media. It's not only in our homes now, it's in our pockets, right? We can take it out any place we want. And so what we're asking people is to think about it. We're not necessarily saying anything is bad or anything is good, but we're saying, you know, we consume, we absorb. What are the results of that? And what are the questions we should be asking about this? Because you and I both know that the power of just a good question is transformative. So that's where we're moving towards with our exhibitry and with our with the programming that we do. We are also we want to be a home for journalists. We have when we were open, we opened our doors to the NABJ to meet there. They used to meet there monthly when we were open, and we've had programs with the SPJ. We've been teaching podcasting. We're transforming that to be. We've been teaching that online. We're teaching the public as well as professionals, and we're hoping to become a hub where not only news media, but also broadcast media from all over can meet with the public to discuss.
All right. And if folks listening to aspiring journalists, young journalists, those in college want to learn more or participate in your program, how will they do that?
They can send me an email. They can, you can, our website is museum.tv. And my email is sschultz@museum.tv. And I am always happy to get information from aspiring journalists. I'm always happy. We do have internships. We do have different programs. We are working with the different colleges in journalism schools in the area. And we're pretty hopeful.
Well, I certainly can't wait for the museum to be reopened after this pandemic, if nothing else, to go there and see the original buckets of the Bozo Show that taped in Chicago. I actually went to the Bozo Show when I was young.
I did too. And I love that. And I think the thing that we're going to do with Bozo and with a number of the other things, is what we really want to make sure is, and we have Charlie McCarthy. You know, there were only, I believe there's only two of them. And one of them is in the Smithsonian, and the other one is here in Chicago. Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer Sturt and Effie Klinker. And these are at the roots of television. And I like to go whenever I see on the monitors that there is young people in front of it, because, you know, there are these wooden puppets and they're kind of looking at them. And I like to run up to them and say, do you know, in their time, Charlie McCarthy was just as more, if not more popular than Beyonce. And we show them all the different stuff and everything, because we want to also make sure that we make history and Bozo, you know, relevant to the next generation. What's their place in the whole scheme of things? Because we went from Bozo to children's programming to Sesame Street, right? And that's where we are now. So there's a line of progression, and there's historical context. And that, again, is learning about what you're consuming.
Well, Susie Schultz is the executive director of Chicago's Museum of Broadcast Communications. Susie, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you, Michael.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. The pandemic has hit businesses in Indiana and Illinois hard. By some estimates, as many as 4,000 small businesses in Illinois have closed permanently. But some think this is the right move to start a new business. I had a chance to speak to three women who have recently opened their own businesses. We start off with Michelle Sear of Northwest Indiana Airport Express. Michelle, how long have you, when did you start the business?
So we started this like just before, right around the time where the pandemic was just getting started, before we really knew how serious it was. And of course, I think we did maybe one or two trips, and then business just came to a complete standstill, obviously, with the travel and industry at sort of a halt. And we really didn't have any travel at all for at least the last 8 or 9 months. And then really kind of did a reset just this last fall and started to really ramp up the promotions for that and then into the new year.
Wow. Okay. And so you would say you guys really started to take off, say, towards the end of last year?
Probably. Yeah. I would say November, you know, what's interesting, what really sort of helped launch us was some of the students at the area universities, since the shuttle stopped running and they really relied heavily on that. What they did was a lot of parents were really scrambling to try to figure out how to get their students home for the break. And they were leaving in November, obviously around Thanksgiving, to head back. And they weren't coming back until actually they're going to start coming back over the next week or so. So that's what really helped kind of launch us. I had a number of inquiries and we tried to, you know, be reasonable, you know, reasonably priced so that they could kind of count on us to get their students safely to the airport.
Wow. So right now, there used to be the shuttle, the USA coach line from Northwest Indiana to the airports. That doesn't exist anymore.
Right. That does not exist anymore. They stopped service, I believe, in the fall of 2019 and then, or like the end of 2019. And then the Royal Excursion, I believe, was going to take their place. And they had announced that they were going to start service again, literally like right around, like, I think it was, I saw a press release. It was like February, early March. And then of course the pandemic hit and then they suspended their service and they haven't come back. And of course, as I was sort of doing my feasibility study, when I was looking into launching our business of looking into all of the different options, you know, on the high end and the lower end in terms of the cost spectrum, and talked with them even more recently. And right now they said if they do offer service, the earliest that they would even be coming back would be in the summer. So we'll see. And even then they're not 100%. There is another service, though, however, Purdue has a shuttle. I cannot recall the name of the company off the top of my head, but they come out of West Lafayette to take the Purdue students to the airports up here. Actually, they really only go to O'Hare. They're not going to Midway right now. So they've made a stop in Hammond. And so they're running right around $60 round trip. So there is a lower priced option out there for folks, but again, where they're stopping in Hammond, there's no overnight parking, and so you have to be dropped off, and you also are only, they're only going to O'Hare, so they're not going to Midway as of right now. So there's a couple options out there, and so we thought, you know, it'd be nice to come in the middle here. We're not a limo service per se, but we are kind of a private car for hire, but could we come in somewhere in the middle to make it affordable for the average family or person traveling who would otherwise really not have many options.
All right.
That was a long answer.
No, it's okay. And let me ask you this. So when you say, is it like a shuttle bus, or is it pretty much like a minivan or something like
that? So right now, you know, we start out with like a newer model. We have a couple Chrysler Town and Countries. We're looking into purchasing a larger 12 passenger Ford Transit van. We have one that we do use right now if we need to, if we have larger parties. And then also looking at like a town car or something, just sort of on the smaller scale for the executive that might be traveling to the airport. So,
all right.
And yeah, it's not a bus. I want to make sure we're not a shuttle bus. We do, you know, offer door-to-door service. So for example, if you were to call and we set up the appointment, I would pick you up at your home, help you with your luggage. They would get you, you know, to the airport, as well as then tracking your flight so that when you're coming and you're flying back in on the inbound, picking you up at arrivals and taking you back home. So it's trying to provide that higher end service, but at a more, affordable cost for the average person.
Now, let me ask you this. Has there been any concern opening or starting a new business during a pandemic?
I think for us, not necessarily, because we can take the precautions, you know, for example, making sure that every vehicle is disinfected before and after a trip. All passengers are required to wear masks. Our drivers are required to wear masks. We even have, for any of our passengers that are maybe a little bit more at risk, but it's likely that they're probably not traveling anyway, but we also have a plastic barrier that we can put up between the drivers and the passengers as well. So we have every option available to take the precautions that are needed to make sure passengers, you know, that they feel safe and that they're comfortable.
All right. So Michelle, I know a little bit about it, but just to get it on record, your background is pretty much in education, correct?
Well, actually my background initially, I started in corporate marketing. So I worked in software and education as an education management company years ago when I did that commute to Chicago, and then crossed over into higher education about 20 years ago when I started working at IU Northwest. And then from there, sort of took the trajectory into different positions throughout higher education at a number of different universities in the Midwest. And my last position was at St. Joe's College in Rensselaer. And unfortunately, since they ceased academic operations a couple of years ago, that put me in a position to kind of reevaluate, okay, where are we going with this? Do I want to, you know, move out of the area to pursue other opportunities? And at the time, I had a couple opportunities to move out of the area and work in another college university. But my son is still pretty young, so we didn't want to pull him out of the school system. Plus, we're so rooted in Northwest Indiana. So that was my opportunity to take a little step back and finish my graduate degree that I had been enrolled in, and was just doing some part-time consulting work and then teaching part-time. And so then we decided to do this business, and it's, you know, it's working out really well. And to truth be told, while I was going, you know, finishing my degree, I actually started to Uber a little bit part-time, and that's kind of what gave me sort of the transportation service bug. And then I also had worked part-time for a local limo company, so I have a little experience with that. So that's kind of how I shifted into this role. And I still, you know, I'm still doing consulting work in higher ed as well as teaching part-time. So, but it's kind of nice.
Do you have a PhD?
I do, actually. that is what I just finished just this last year, right before the pandemic. I was fortunate enough to be able to walk through graduation before we locked everything down, and poor kids last year weren't able to do that for the class of 2020. So I do. It's a PhD in education, but an emphasis in higher education leadership.
So far, how has it gone?
So far, it's gone really well. Pleasantly surprised. And I'm really, since I just started a new campaign about a week and a half ago, actually going into almost week two, even just on Facebook, the responses have been huge. I'm quoting, you know, quite a few every day, and I've already booked probably 20 trips in like a week. So we're going to be looking at, okay, what's the plan now if we get so busy where we're, you know, not able to accommodate everyone. And I've already got a couple partnerships in place with some other local companies where, for example, if there's one of us that's going to the airport and we're dropping someone off, but then we have nobody coming back and they need someone to pick up somebody at O'Hare or Midway. So it's like a little bit of a network there. We're kind of partnering. And I think that'll be very successful, and it will help each other out as well.
All right. And where do you see this going? If you're busy now and mm-hmm. things start to open up even more, so that definitely means people are flying a little bit more.
Right.
Are you prepared to expand your service or take on more vehicles, or are you just trying to keep it slow, kind of manageable right now?
right now we just want to kind of keep it manageable. However, I'm really watching the trends to see as people start to travel more and as we continue to get more folks that want to travel and need our services. We are in a position to expand by adding a couple vehicles. We've also got a couple drivers that have reached out to offer their services that they're interested. I'm not hiring necessarily right now, but we have a sort of in our back pocket, we've got a couple people. You know, you have to be careful with that too, because you don't want to just hire anybody to drive. You have to be careful. If you're trying to offer a certain service level, no matter what business you're in, you need to make sure obviously there's some sort of training and they're going to, you know, meet that standard, as well as have an impeccable driving record, because, you know, the liability is on you as the business owner, regardless of who's working for you, and making sure that they're going to provide that same level of service. So you don't, you know, you continue to build your business and not lose business. So I think that's really, really important. So I really would kind of move cautiously down that road, but, you know, thoughtfully, and just have a really good plan as we start to get busier.
Is this service done by you and your husband?
Right. So my husband and I are both, you know, sort of equal partners in this.
And what's your husband's name?
Jim.
And he does a lot of the driving as well?
I usually do most of it, but then he'll pick up if, for example, we have a larger group and we need a couple vehicles. If we can't get, you know, the other, the larger vehicle in place yet, he'll help with that. And I do the bulk of the driving, but then he's kind of my backup. I hear him in the background. He's so, like, you want to pipe in? He's not an on-camera kind of guy, so.
That's okay. Let me ask you this. Was there any worry, or did anybody tell you, Michelle, right now just is not the time to start a business?
No, nobody ever told me that, because I usually don't listen to too many people. I'm pretty, I'm pretty strong-willed. So if I feel that, and pretty intuitive. So if I feel that there's a need or a service that needs to be offered, I just run with it. And, you know, I did my research, and obviously back when this all first started, I questioned it, my sanity, what are you thinking, you know? But we didn't have a whole lot invested back then. So it really wasn't a big hit. We just kind of rolled with it like everybody else did. Unfortunately, so many other businesses have really been hurting from this pandemic, and you know, gratefully and thankfully we've been able to manage it fairly well. But now is kind of looking up and people are starting to travel more, so we're pretty optimistic and hopeful about the future, and people feeling more comfortable kind of getting out a little bit more as this vaccine becomes more available as well.
Let me ask you this. What would you tell people? I mean, they are seeing the headlines that so many businesses are closing or slowing down. What would you tell people if they're thinking about starting a business, especially women?
Well, I think if you're thinking about starting a business, you have to really think about what is the business that you're wanting to start, where your skills and your expertise lie. I mean, obviously, you know, I never thought that I'd be doing transportation per se, but, you know, we adapt sometimes, and we need to in order to survive. And I think if you were to open up a new business right now, really be thoughtful. What is the product that you're offering? What is the service level that you are willing to provide? And you have to be willing to adapt and change. So for example, businesses that may not have, let's take a restaurant, for example, that really was sit down only, didn't even have an outdoor space, didn't offer curbside or delivery. You know, they had to change pretty quick. So I think anybody going into business right now needs to have those plans in place, depending on what the business is and if it can be delivered in different modes, so to speak. Not everybody's able to adapt, and, you know, but that's something, especially if you're starting out from scratch and thinking about, I want to start a business, you know, doing your due diligence and researching and doing the market research. Is this a product or is this a service that people need, and how am I going to deliver it? So making sure you kind of cover all those bases. I think that's the best advice that you can give to try to minimize any of those surprises. Try to be prepared for anything. What do they say? Hope for the best, but plan for the worst. So very true in business too.
And you probably don't have, though, a lot of the overhead, a lot of other older businesses might have that they just maybe have so many employees and just it's crushing them. Right. So you probably don't have that kind of overhead stuff, though, right?
Thankfully, no, we don't, you know, but we, you know, we do have, obviously, when it comes to the fleet, you need to maintain your vehicles. They have to be, you know, very well maintained and insurance and that sort of thing. So, but our expenses are nowhere near some of the other businesses. I mean, even some of the local limo and airport shuttle type companies in the area, you know, they've really suffered because they're, especially the limo companies, when they stopped the weddings and, well, the weddings weren't necessarily stopped, but the larger gatherings, if you will, the wine tours and all of that, that they really rely on for their livelihood. And they were employing people. So they really, really suffered. So thankfully we're not in that position right now to have to worry about that. So we just kind of keep it small and keep plugging along. So.
And that was Michelle Sear, owner and operator of Northwest Indiana Airport.
Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Many folks live their whole life in Northwest Indiana, and many have never cruised Lake Michigan or watched the sunset over Marquette Park or settled the burger wars between Minor Dunn and Shoups. Those are just some of the 100 things you need to do before you die in Northwest Indiana. And that's the name of the book written by Joseph Pete, award-winning reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, welcome to Off Mic.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Thank you for coming on. I know you're very busy. So have you personally done these 100 things in Northwest Indiana before you die?
I have done nearly all of them, pretty much. I'm a region native. I was born in Hammond. I grew up in Highland. I decamped for a while. Like, I was in the Army and stationed out by Fort Lewis near Seattle and Washington. I lived down in Indy for a few years, but I did, you know, end up coming back, circling back to the region, like a salmon kind of returning home, or, you know, but I've long been a big proponent for the region. I love the region. It's my home. It's a very unique, special area, a very hardworking place. We built all the great skyscrapers in the 20th century. We built all the cars. It's a, you know, very diverse melting pot. It's just a very unique place with its own cuisines and traditions. And I try to advocate for the region as much as I can, whether I'm writing about like a local arts group or somebody starting a small business or, and then, you know, I just generally appreciate all things region. I've done pretty much nearly everything in this book. There are a couple things like windsurf on Wolf Lake. Mm-hmm. I've not actually windsurfed there. It was named by like Men's Journal as one of the top windsurfing spots in like the country. But I do like going on like walks there, and I often circle around the lake. But I've got pretty much firsthand experience with virtually everything in the book.
You know, there are a lot of things in here, and you'd be surprised. There are people who, you know, live in Northwest Indiana, and you got to forget. We keep forgetting Northwest Indiana is a big place. So let's say you're living in Hammond, you may not get out to LaPorte County or parts of Porter County all that much, and vice versa. I have friends now who are adults who grew up in Portage and Valpo, but they rarely ventured in to East Chicago where I grew up. So, like, for example, you have, and I know a lot of people have not done this. I've done it both as a reporter, and I know some kids have done it, but maple syrup time at Shelburg Farm, that's always a fun time to do. Have you done that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, we love visiting the Indiana Dunes National Park. I often make a point of going. That's definitely one, you know, special thing that they have every year. I think you can also get the maple syrup year round.
Right.
But there's but with the national, that's part of the reason I wrote the book, too, because with the national park, for instance, like, everybody's been to the beaches. Everybody's been to West Beach. Everybody's been to the Indiana Dunes State Park. But there's so much like the Tolston Dunes. There's so much like off the beaten path that people don't get out to, like, even within just the national park system here. Like, right. You know, the people miss out on, like, that event. They don't necessarily, you know, the book does, you know, kind of talk about some of the more, like, heavily promoted stuff, like the Three Dunes Challenge and so forth. But it's, you know, there's there's a lot of like great hiking, and you could go see like great blue herons, and there's all kinds of like the Homes of Tomorrow, for instance, in Beverly Shores. Like, there's all kinds of off the beaten path stuff that's part of the probably, you know, Indiana Dunes National Park system
that
people should get out and see, not just like the beach. And I kind of wanted to give people a guidebook to, you know, of
check it
you
off
know,
their
all
list.
The cool different stuff they could do. And what you said was very accurate, like with the, because a lot of it, because like I had never been, up until recently, I had never seen the Sandhill Cranes in the Jasper Pulaski Wildlife Area. I never really ventured out that way. But that was part of the reason why I came back, because there, I felt like there was a lot of, here, like a lot of rich history and nature and art and everything. And, you know, when you're growing up here as a kid, you don't necessarily appreciate it. It's so easy just to go to Chicago and do things in the city and, you know, or stick around your hometown, and you don't necessarily get out and explore, like, everything the region has to offer. And it is a big, sprawling area. It's bigger than a lot of, you know, between Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties, it's bigger than, you know, many cities like Kansas City or Cleveland or even, like, a Miami or Boston in terms of population. And it's [S2] Sure. [S1] A very diverse place. Like, you have a very, you know, variety of environments from urban to rural, and it's just everything in between, and there's just a lot to see and do and explore, and there's just a lot of unique stuff you can do here that you can't really do anywhere else, like the Northwest Indiana Oilmen in Whiting. Like, where else can you, you know, sit and watch a minor league baseball game by the flare stacks of, like, the largest inland refinery in the United States? Like, it's just right. not an experience you're going to find, you know, anywhere else in the world.
That's right. And I know a lot of people, one of the things that I really enjoy, especially when you talk about Lake Michigan, is, and it's kind of comes out of the blue, you talked about the Century of Progress homes in Porter County. That's a real treat, and a lot of people don't realize that they are right there. They have this big pink flamingo Floridian style home right on the shores of Lake Michigan. I know it's being threatened now by erosion and the waves and everything. I believe that's Beverly Shores, actually. And I mean, it kind of sticks out. I was like, wait a minute, who built a pink house in Lake Michigan? Well, that was part of the turn of the Century of Progress, a World's Fair in Chicago more than 100 years ago. That was in Chicago. That was then. Those homes were brought by barge to Northwest Indiana. But a lot of people don't see that. They don't get to experience it. And, yeah, you need to get over there and look at it before either erosion gets to them or you die. That's right. Well, what are some of the things that I know? I mean, you got 100 things in here. But if let's say somebody was coming from London or from Japan, you were trying to give them like 3 or 4, you know, a couple of things that are quintessential Northwest Indiana, not Chicago-like, because, you know, Chicago got its thing. If you had to show them, like, you need to go here, then you could say you've been to Northwest Indiana. What is, like, one of the things that you think somebody needs to do?
Oh, that's a very tough question. To narrow it down would be tough. I would just recommend a lot of the definitely the Indiana Dunes would probably be a lot of the cuisine. I think I would try to be very comprehensive and inclusive with a lot of the unique cuisine here we have, whether it's like Polish food or lemon rice soup or gyros or the queso fundido at El Taco Real or square cut pizza or the region style crispy ice burgers or, you know, Serbian food and Greek food. And I just tried to be as like comprehensive as possible. But that's one thing I would definitely recommend to anyone is sampling as much as the cuisine as possible. We do borrow it obviously a lot from Chicagoland, you know, Italian beef and Chicago dogs and so forth. But it's, you know, there's a lot here that you're not going to find throughout much of the Midwest. And there's just a lot of great places with a lot of the restaurant ones. I tried to just include as many like Greek diners as possible as to, you know, steer people that way. Because part of it, we do get, you know, we're not really thought of as like a tourist destination. We're not like, you know, Chicago or New York or anything. But we do get a lot of visitors here. It's just they come like, you know, they go to visit the national park or they go to, you know, Dark Lord Day or they go for, you know, they normally come for some specific reason. And then part of the motivation writing the book was also kind of to steer those people to, if you're going to come for the dunes, even for just like a weekend or whatever from Ohio, you know, here's some stuff you can come and like, you know, to kind of fully appreciate the area and not just, you know, because we get people all over people from Europe and all over the world go to visit the Michael Jackson house, even though it's just a quick, you know, you kind of paying your homage, paying your respects and just, you know, seeing like the humility of the circumstances he grew up in and then leaving. But the I just tried to suggest stuff that's both kind of both musty stuff, but also kind of quintessential like region experiences, like you know, biking on the Erie Lackawanna Trail and hiking through the Gibson Woods, and you know, catching a basketball game at the Arc in Valparaiso. And stuff
that is
it's
a big deal.
Not necessarily all for like visitors, but it's like stuff. It's just easy to live here and not, you know, have the full range of the region experience. And I was just trying to, you know, offer suggestions for how people can kind of, you know, experience that more fully, I guess.
No, absolutely. Because there are a lot of things that people, you know, just may take for granted. You have, you say you need to visit, you know, Miller Beach in Gary, which you'd be surprised a lot of people outside of Gary do not visit Miller as much as they should. It's actually it's like a little town within a city, and it's so unique. It's so wonderful, especially during the summertime and when there's no, you know, construction traffic on Lake Street over there. There's so many things to do and everything. You know, how long did it take you to actually put this book together?
This book, it was around 6 months that it took to write this one. It's kind of a brisk read. It's 100 things. It's part of a series. It's by Reedy Press out of St. Louis, Missouri. And I was kind of looking at I was long a fan of, there was a former Chicago Tribune, I think he's former, Chicago Tribune reporter who had written A Native Guide to Northwest Indiana. And when I was living down in Indy, I really appreciated like reading that book, because it was kind of a, you know, great like travel guide and guide to the region. But it was the last like kind of general interest kind of travelogue book about Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. It was published about 20 years ago, so it's a little bit out of date. And then, you know, there's a lot of history books published about the region. I wrote one, even Lost Hammond, but it's like there just wasn't a lot about the region today. You know, you get 100 books coming out about Indianapolis and 1,000 books coming out about Chicago, but it's, you know, this is an area that's not necessarily like plumbed as much. And I just wanted to kind of, you know, celebrate a lot of the institutions we have here, whether, you know, like the Albany's Candy Factory or the Chapel of the Resurrection of Valparaiso or Lemon Rice Soup or Punchki Day, you know, both our traditions and the places to visit. I've written a history book too, and that one was a lot more like research intensive, because a lot of this I've either had first hand experience with, I've reported on it for the Times, I've, you know, lived it, I've done it, and I've written about it like extensively, you know, previously, or talked about it on a podcast I used to do. But it was a lot of it's kind of just like almost an ode to Northwest Indiana, like a love letter to Northwest Indiana. Like I described, like a lot of the experiences, like the beach at the Indiana Dunes, or what, you know, what it's like to, you know, take that first bite of a Chicago dog, or, you know, or at Redabacks in Southwest Michigan, or.
You know, unfortunately, a lot of the things that are in your book right now is going to have to wait until after the pandemic, because the very first thing in your book is Feast on Starch at Pierogi Fest. And we all know the Pierogi Fest, one of the victims last summer of the coronavirus shutdown. And hopefully sometime this year we can get back to enjoying Pierogi Fest. But we know there won't be a Dark Lord Day at over there in Munster with Three Floyds Brewing. I mean, this coronavirus has really taken a chunk out of a lot of things, but there's still a lot of great things to do in Northwest Indiana.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the book came out at a very unfortunate time, like smack dab in the middle of a pandemic. And it's especially, you know, especially when it's a book where it's kind of a travelogue, and that there are some stuff, you know, there's a lot of recommendations here that you can't safely do during the pandemic. Like a lot of it is outdoor hiking,
sure,
and that type of thing. But as you pointed out, like a lot of, or visiting like Marktown and, you know, seeing the, you know, workers community, the idyllic Swiss village where, you know, people could park on the sidewalks and walk in the street. But a lot of the stuff out here is on hold like the rest of the world, unfortunately.
That's right.
So far it has, like, you know, Valparaiso Jazz Fest or the Challenger Learning Center, you know, those types of things. But there's a lot of outdoor stuff that, you know, people are still able to do when the weather is, you know, nicer. But yeah, a lot of it will have to wait. But hopefully when, you know, the vaccines are distributed more widely and kind of life starts to get a little bit closer back to normal, you know, it might be a guide to getting out of the house and, you know, fuel your imagination with ideas and stuff to do with, you know, your spouse or your family or what have you.
Well, Joseph Pete is the author of 100 Things to Do in Gary and Northwest Indiana Before You Die. Joseph Pete is also an award-winning reporter with the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
No problem. And that is all we have time for today for Off Mic. I'd like to thank my producers and all the guests for today's show. You can hear the show again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. For me, Michael Puente, stay safe, stay warm, and enjoy the weekend. Thank you for listening.
This is 89.1 FM, The Lakeshore. Listener-supported podcast.